I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. President Barack Obama met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today. It was a much-anticipated meeting between the Israeli Prime Minister and President Barack Obama. They couldn't be further apart in many ways in terms of their view of Middle East peace and the question of Palestinian statehood, the future of Jerusalem, settlements, which President Barack Obama did say today he thinks have to stop and cannot be expanded. President Netanyahu has made it clear he's not yet used the word Palestinian statehood. He has talked about living side by side in peace and many other things, but not talked about statehood. So we're going to talk about the question of the Middle East peace, where it is. Pretty soon Barack Obama will be meeting with leaders from throughout the Middle East. On June the 4th, he'll be giving a major address from Cairo to the Muslim world, which we'll be covering as well here on the Mark Steiner Show, here on WEAA. The question of Mideast peace, as I've been saying for years on this program, is critical to the center of world peace, and we're going to talk about that this hour. We're joined in studio by Dr. Robert Friedman, and Dr. Robert Friedman has been a guest on the show for the 16 years of its existence. He is visiting professor of political science now at Johns Hopkins University, the author of 4 books on the Soviet foreign policy, and the editor of 14 books on Israel and the Middle East. Dr. Waleed Hasbun is with us. He has been on the guest on the show numerous times in the last several years. He's an assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University and author of Beaches, Ruins, Resorts, The Politics of Tourism in the Arab World. And Bob and Waleed, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Pleasure, Mark.
So let's talk about what's going on here. It's really interesting how little has come out of this White House meeting. We have heard very little of any substance. And I guess many of us expected that was going to be the case. Given the tenuousness of this relationship, and when Barack Obama was in Israel and met Netanyahu, they made much about their becoming very friendly and talking about what they both faced. And I think Obama was quoted as saying to Netanyahu, "See, I stood on the left and had to move to the center, and you stood on the right, and you have to move to the center," or some kind of exchange back and forth like that. But clearly, this is much more serious going on at the moment. And I want to ask both of you, starting with Waleed and then go to Bob, to talk about why you think it's been so quiet on the announcement front here.
I think it's striking how the expectations, somehow in the media was portraying that maybe some sort of confrontation, laying out the notion that Obama has put forward this idea that he wants some sort of peace agreement, that he feels it's very important, and Obama's a very smart guy who is taking on so many other crises, and this is one that he's put on his agenda throughout for his administration. And we're at the starting point, and so it's true Netanyahu doesn't support a two-state solution, doesn't publicly support it, but we couldn't expect that there would be a confrontation. These are, leaders of two states that have, strong relations. They're not going to come up to a confrontation unless there's something at stake, unless Obama can make some sort of offer to Netanyahu and he would be offering him something in return for a concession. And I think we're too early to get to that point. And the critical things are probably going on in the background. Maybe President Obama is laying out a little bit about what he expects in the future. That's something that would go on within closed doors. The other thing that wasn't reports say that Netanyahu spent a lot of time talking about Iran, and I don't think the public press conference focused it on it as much. So to some degree, we're still at this very sort of a tricky time. And the bigger questions, which I think we can get to later, is that what's the American position in the region, and does Obama have any strategy that can work to transform it? And I think that's a very difficult, complex problem, and I think he's just beginning to map it out. And the question is, will he think there's a solution or not, and what will he do once he thinks there is?
That we will get to that point. I'm glad you raised that, and don't let me forget we have to get there, Waleed. Bob Friedman.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Let me just follow up on what my colleague Waleed said. I think the issue is there are 6 very serious issues at stake, and to believe that they could be solved in a meeting of an hour and a half or even the extra half hour, 2 hours, I think, was a bit too optimistic. Let me just tick them off quickly. 1, two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Obama again came down strongly on that today. At most, Netanyahu would say two peoples living in peace. Settlements and settlement outposts is the second issue. They differ on that. Iran, there was a little bit of movement on this. Netanyahu came into the meeting saying Iran first. Obama came, so no, if we solve the Arab-Israeli conflict, this will help us with Iran. So there are opposite positions on that. They sort of came together a little bit, and this is the only progress that I saw today, at least in the open discussion at the press conference, and that is we'll work on both of these simultaneously. Fourth was the Arab peace plan that didn't come up in the discussion, but that's very important because Obama has endorsed parts of it. The Arab peace plan calls for Israeli withdrawal of 67 border and a just solution to the Palestinian peace problem. There are some positive things Obama sees in it. Netanyahu's concerned that the Arab interpretation of the peace plan is that the Palestinian refugees return to Israel proper rather than to a Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza. They didn't even get to that today. Fifth issue is Arab recognition of Israel as a Jewish state. Now, Netanyahu did mention this in the press conference today. Obama didn't comment on it, and I think this is going to be an interesting element of for final peace discussion. And the sixth issue, which got no coverage, was that if Fatah, which controls the West Bank, and Hamas, which controls Gaza, and they're currently at loggerheads, but should they form a national unity government, would the United States provide economic aid to that government? From Netanyahu's point of view, this legitimates Hamas. From the U.S. point of view, unless you can get Hamas and Fatah working again, you're never going to have peace with Israel. So these are six very strong substantive issues. And I think they were just basically able to scratch the surface. It's possible they'll set up some working commissions to deal with them more. But remember, Obama's not just meeting with Netanyahu. He met with King Abdullah II of Jordan. He's going to be meeting with Mubarak of Egypt. Then he's making the speech, as you mentioned. So he's gathering information now. At the same time, he's got to deal with the fire in Pakistan and Afghanistan with an American economy, which isn't yet out of the woods, and a whole series of other issues. So there's a question of how much presidential time that Obama can give. And let me just say, in closing this first part, he sort of reached out to Obama today. He said, look, you're a wise man. You have the capability of really producing peace. So he made this personal gesture to Netanyahu. And Netanyahu, of course, made a personal gesture to Obama. How far these personal gestures will go remains to be seen.
We're talking about what happened today in Washington, D.C. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with President Barack Obama. The number is 410-319-8888. I'll write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You just heard Dr. Robert Friedman, who is visiting professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Waleed Hasbun is assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, joining us to talk about Mideast peace, 410-319-8888. Let me ask some very tough questions of both of you right now, though, about America, and then I'm going to go back to Netanyahu and Iran and the larger issue of peace Arab League Secretary General Amir Moussa said today as well. In America, we have a Jewish community which is very powerful and politically strong, has been for a long time, and that is represented by many different groups. But the group that holds at least the K Street sway in Washington, D.C., is AIPAC. And recently, Newt Gingrich spoke at AIPAC, as did Congressman Cantor from Virginia. And I read Congressman Cantor's speech this morning on the train back from Washington, where I had a meeting. And I was really kind of taken aback by the speech when I read Cantor's speech. It was pretty strident. And that part of the issue is here that AIPAC has so much power in Washington that other voices out of, just say, the Jewish community that sees a different version of what Middle East peace is, voices not heard as loudly, does not have the power and the money, and how much that holds sway over elections and over the opening of dialogue in America. Anybody want to grab this one first, gentlemen? Ed Bob, and then we'll go to Waleed.
Okay. Well,
I think it was only right to start with you and then go to Waleed.
Okay. Yeah. if you look at the lobby, the pro-Israel lobby in the United States, it's made up of five groups. One is the Jewish community. Second are evangelical Christians. Third is American labor. Fourth are U.S. military people. And why? Because they like to see American weapons doing really good job in the hands of Israelis over former Soviet weapons. And five, basically those people, and there are Republicans and Democrats, Jews and Christians, who see Israel as a democracy in a non-democratic area and argue common values. Now, in the case of AIPAC, interestingly enough, they've come out for a two-state solution, and this goes against Netanyahu. And they're being pushed by a new Jewish organization in town called J Street, which is basically the Jewish peace lobby in town. It's made up of Peace Now, the Israeli Policy Forum, and other groups. And they are pushing very hard for the administration to come out very strongly, A, for a two-state solution, and B, to stop the settlements. Now, Truth in Advertising, I'm a member of that through being by virtue of being a member of Peace Now, being on the right wing of Peace Now. But
we were both in Peace Now together.
Yes, yes.
I was on the left wing of Peace Now. You were on the right wing of Peace Now.
Peace Now. Right. But still.
We're still friends.
Yeah. And we marched together.
We marched together. We did, yes.
Yeah. the issue being here that AIPAC is now being pushed. Now, to what degree – before you had a situation with a conservative American president, Mr. Bush, whose basic sympathies were in touch with the conservatives who are running AIPAC. Now you have a different ballgame. You have a left-of-center American president, a right-of-center Israeli prime minister. And when this happens once before with Clinton, if you remember, Netanyahu had two things going for him, which sort of gave him protection against Clinton. One was it was Republican Congress headed by Newt Gingrich, if you recall. And second, the Monica Lewinsky affair. And that gave him a certain amount of protection against Clinton. Now you don't have that. Obama's very, very popular, and there's a strongly Democratic Congress. So I think you have a slightly different balance of power in Washington between Israel and the United States. While there's still, as was mentioned very strongly today in the press conference, worrying about Israeli security, this does not mean support for Israeli settlements. And it does mean a two-state solution. So at some point, depending on how things go, and again, whether there's a reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah and whether this new national unity government will accept the idea of a two-state solution to recognize Israel. Those two big Fs, if that happens, then I think you may see some American pressure on Israel, irregardless of AIPAC.
Waleed?
Yeah, I think it's clear that the lobby and pro-Israeli sympathies really shape much of Congress and the views you hear from Congress. The bigger question is, I do believe if a president does have a strategy that's going to promote U.S. interests, and it's definitely going to be a strategy that's going to incorporate, the Israeli security. And, to the degree that he wants to put forward some policies that are in support of that, then I think a president can move. I don't think a lobby in itself can prevent that. The question is, will they come up with that type of solution? That nobody's going to put pressure on Israel in the face of the Israeli lobby if they're not getting anything back. If there's a deal to be made, like they did in the switch in the mid-1990s, the Israeli lobby can come around to redefining their support for Israel within a new framework. So this is one thing I see missing. And the other question is, will those ideas for a new configuration, will that debate about new ideas be constrained by, let's say, the lack of ideas in Washington and so forth? And I think you see some sense that the Obama administration is at least open to certain ideas, open to the idea of if there was a unity government, a Palestinian unity government, that the U.S. would have some dealings with it, like foreign aid. They put out feelers to Syria. So they're at least beginning with the idea of rethinking some policies, and especially coming after Bush, where there was a real consolidation between the American right, the conservatives, the evangelical Christians, and the Israeli lobby. Now that, let's say, coalition, I don't think as tight as it was under Bush, and Obama did a job, I believe, winning a majority of the American Jewish vote. And so I think he has some ability to begin to redefine what what U.S. policy should be and how what would be in the long run good for Israel. If he can, you know, come up with a strategy like that, I think he can sell it.
Well, what ends up in this in some sense of being good for the Palestinians in all this? And I ask that starting with the new Israeli government, where, you know, Israeli political opinion, like every other political opinion, swings and moves over the years from one extreme to the other. And in this government, you have the foreign minister being Avigdor Lieberman, who has made some pretty outlandish racist statements over the years and pretty outlandish statements since he's been foreign minister. And it makes, I mean, this makes some very tough negotiations when you have a foreign minister who's pretty rigid ideologically and in terms of his attitude towards Arabs, Palestinians in general, and how that plays in all this. Bob, you want to start them and go to Walid?
Yeah, two things about Lieberman. Remember, the person making policy is Netanyahu. It's not Lieberman. And in all the years I've gone to Israel to do interviews in the foreign ministry, and it goes back now 40 years, not a single time was I not told they don't take us seriously here in the foreign ministry. The foreign policy is run out of the prime minister's office. I mean, we saw that with Olmert and Tzipi Livni. We've seen this with the various people with Sharon. I think Lieberman was given this job primarily because he brings 15 seats into the coalition. Without those 15 seats, even though he currently, Netanyahu has 74, that's really the keystone of the coalition. That having been said, Lieberman is in favor of a two-state solution, interestingly enough. So you have within the government, Lieberman in favor of a two-state solution and the defense minister in charge of a two-state solution. And only Netanyahu among the top three leaders is not yet in favor of a two-state solution. Now, you may question Lieberman's motives. Lieberman looks at the world through the eyes of the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots. He said when they were living together, they constantly fought, and the situation is much better now. The Turks control the north of Cyprus. The Greeks control the south, and you could go back to 1923 after the Greeks invaded Turkey, if you remember, at the end of World War I. And the Turks won that war. There was an exchange of populations. And ultimately, Greece and Turkey began to improve their relations. Anyway, this is what Lieberman's saying. He's saying, look, it's very clear, particularly with some Israeli Arab leaders siding with Hamas and Hezbollah, there's no way that the two peoples can live together peacefully. Let's separate out Umm al-Fahm and some of these areas, add them to the Palestinian state, switch it for Ma'ala Adumim and the Gush Etzion bloc. Therefore, there'll be a minimum of Arabs in Israel, only those who pledge allegiance to the Jewish state, quote unquote. The people wouldn't have to leave their homes. And ultimately, Arabs living without any Jews on a Palestinian state and Jews living with minimal number of Arabs in a Jewish state, and that's how you get peace. Now, you may agree or disagree with this perspective of Lieberman, but this is what he's saying.
You're always a great, always have great analysis, Bob, in our conversations over the years, and even now. But I mean, you're painting Avigdor Lieberman this really, from my look, right wing racist Israeli
who wants a two state solution.
But he, in the words he uses, he liked to cleanse Israel of its Arab population. He liked to get rid of them all. I mean, so it's – he may be for a two-state solution, but what I'm saying is when you have a mindset that's powerful, that vociferous against Arab people, that's a tough place to start.
On the other hand, if you look at what's happened in the last 8 years since the Al-Aqsa Intifada, or maybe going even back to Land Day in 1975, you have a progressive Palestinianization of the Israeli Arab community, particularly with the leadership within the three Arab parties, United Arab List and Balad, to a less extent in Hadash, which is the Communist Party. And they are openly siding, as Lieberman said, with Hamas and Hezbollah, who are the enemies of Israel. And he then questions, given these circumstances, is there really a way for these people to live in peace with Israel? And he raises a question. Now, rank-and-file Israeli Arabs have not yet moved to the position of their leaders. But according to polls, if one believes it, including denial of the Holocaust, et cetera, they're beginning to move in that direction. So all I will say is if you look at the past history which Lieberman has cited, okay, and if all possibilities are on the table, if we can work out a two-state solution, which I think is the number one goal here, some territorial exchange should not ipso facto be ruled out.
Walid Hasbun.
Yeah, this brings up some of the reasons why the two-state solution is really, I mean, one, it's not clear it's fully viable, and it's really lost its luster as a solution to the, let's say, the Palestinian problem as well as the aspirations, I think, of both Israelis and Palestinians. I mean, bringing up this notion of population transfer, land transfer, ethnic cleansing would just add a whole new dimension to the two-state solution. Could create a whole new separate Palestinian problem. And the other let's say tension behind, let's say, on the Israeli side of the Palestinian problem is this notion of, let's say, the character of Israel as a state. Is it a state of its citizens or is it a Jewish state? And the Palestinian citizens of Israel, as Bob was talking about, have felt more and more marginalized. I mean, if you look at the history, at first after 48, they lived under basically military rule. And then there was a period of attempting to assimilate them. And but as they, and you have this trend of and I think Israel runs into a problem to the degree that Palestinian citizens of Israel seek to be assimilated within Israel, they run up against the notion that they're not full citizens, that they're really second-class citizens within a Jewish state. To the degree that they seek to identify themselves as Palestinian Arabs with a conception as a separate community outside of Israel's Jewish sort of nation, then they run up against that other tension of being seen as more of a, say, internal threat. So I think they really have nowhere to really go. And this is a big tension for both this community within Israel as well as for Israelis and the future of, say, Israeli security.
Let me expand this conversation a little further, and maybe it's to both of you, maybe you, Bob, this is fantasy land, but let me take it there anyway for a moment. When we talk about the future of Israel and Palestinians in this area, and then I do want to come in a more specific conversation about President Barack Obama's Middle Eastern and policy in general, and beyond the state of Israel and the future Palestinian state. Number, by the way, is 410-319-8888. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Your thoughts on the Israeli-Palestinian issues, on President Barack Obama's position in the Middle East, on his meetings with Benjamin Netanyahu today, and King Abdullah of Jordan, coming meetings with Mubarak, and his speech coming up to the Muslim world on June the 4th, which we'll be talking about in some depth on that day. Perhaps have these gentlemen back, among others, to talk about that at that day. And the gentlemen are Dr. Robert Friedman and Dr. Walid Hasbun, both at Johns Hopkins University now. 410-319-8888 is the number here. I was reading an interesting poll. And this poll I was reading was a poll of Palestinians who live in Israel proper, Israeli Arabs, who make up over 20% of the Israeli population at the moment. It said 75% of the Israeli Arabs, this was a poll done, the Haifa University professor, Sami Smuha's poll, who did this poll. And Haifa is a town in northern Israel. Haifa University is a university that has a lot of Israeli Arabs as students, and it's a kind of mixed Israeli-Arab city.
Palestinian-Israelis, I think, is now the more accurate term.
Palestinian-Israelis is the accurate term. Thank you very much, Bob.
That sounds fair to
you. The 75% of Palestinian Israelis between the ages of 16 and 22 support voluntary national service. Now, that would change, if that was true when that happened, it would change the nature of Israel, because it would mean that Israeli Palestinians, mm-hmm. Muslims and Christians would be in the Israeli army. That changes a lot if that happened. 68% said they would be willing to live in a Jewish neighborhood. 80% would like, this is interesting because this makes me think of America pre-1965, would like to see Arabs enjoy parks and share swimming pools with Jews, which are now pretty much separate in Israel. 53% feel rejected as citizens of Israel. 75% think Arabs support support the return of refugees only to a Palestinian state, only to a Palestinian state. Because a big issue in the Israeli-Palestinian talks is what happens to the millions of Palestinian refugees living in Lebanon and elsewhere. And that 45% feel closer to Jews in Israel than Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. But also, interestingly enough, the poll always said the results were 40% deny the Holocaust happened, 47% believe the Jews are liars. Of course, when I saw a poll recently about Jews and Palestinians, the number was higher about Palestinians being liars from the Israeli-Jewish perspective. And 40% believe Jews use the Holocaust to appropriate and discriminate against Palestinian Israelis. So this is an interesting poll, and there also is an interesting dynamic that's growing. And what this portends about the future of both the Israeli state and a Palestinian state. Some say it may be too late for them to really separate at all. Your thoughts? Waleed, why don't you start this one off?
In some ways, I think it's difficult to separate them, and you can even go back to the original partition plan. I mean, the whole idea of partition is not something Palestinians have supported until the late 1980s, when under the PLO they accepted the notion of a two-state solution. But the very idea has always been, the idea of partition is something that was always leading Palestinians to be rooted from their territory. So. There's has always been a tension, even from the early Zionist movement in the Mandate Palestine and before. So, just separating out these communities, one is very difficult. It's unrooting people from their territory. And so, what would it take within some sort of nation for these different communities to all feel included and live peacefully is, would require a different solution. Let's say than the kinds of nation states that the two-state solution seeks to envision.
Now, before, Bob, let me take a short break and come right back after this break. Dr. Robert Friedman, Dr. Waleed Hasbunna with us. Number here is 410-319-8888. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. Over 7 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And we're joined this hour by Dr. Waleed Hasbunna, who you just heard a moment ago, who is assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, author of Beaches, Ruins, Resorts, The Politics of Tourism in the Arab World. Dr. Robert Friedman is a visiting professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. For years was the Peggy Meyerhoff professor of political science at Baltimore Hubie University and was president there for a while. The author of 4 books on Soviet foreign policy and editor of 14 books on Israel and the Middle East. We're talking about Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to the United States of America as Prime Minister of Israel, visiting with President Barack Obama. The number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And as we're going to break, Bob, we were talking about this poll about Israeli Palestinians and what they're saying about their life as Israeli citizens. And we were talking about whether or not, in some ways, it is almost too late to make the break.
Well, the fascinating thing about the poll is when originally the idea was raised about the Palestinian-Israeli / Israeli-Arabs, whatever you want to call them, wanting to do national service, their national leadership strongly opposed it. But it's interesting, the rank and file now came out in support of it.
Here's one that the members of the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, who are
right,
are,
and some of the mayors Arabs, as well, right. strongly right. opposed it. Now, when we're talking about Israeli-Arabs / Palestinian-Israelis, we have to be careful in our terminology, because there are really three groups. Druze, D-R-U-Z-E,
smallest
mostly
group.
In the Galilee, a small group, but tends to be more integrated in Israeli life, do serve in the army. The Bedouin in the south, in the Negev, some of whom serve as trackers in the army and in the border police, and the majority who are Muslim Arabs who
Muslim and Christian Arabs.
Yeah, and Christian, although Christian Arabs do serve in the army. The dilemma facing a Palestinian-Israeli / Israeli-Arab is this. They're members of a country which is at war with their nation. And even though there's peace between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Jordan, there's ongoing struggle with the other Palestinians, some of whom they're married to, some of whom live in Lebanon, some of whom live in Jordan, some who live in Gaza, some of whom live in Syria. So you're caught in a real problem. Here I live in a state which is at war with other members of my family. From the Israeli perspective on this, well, how can you trust these people? So this is A. B, in terms of Jewish state versus Arab state, if you remember what the UN partition resolution said that Waleed was talking about in 1947, it divided the old mandate of Palestine, which belonged to Britain, into an Arab state and a Jewish state. And it was specifically said a Jewish state and specifically said an Arab state. Now, whether you can untangle everything, I mean, when I was doing interviews among Palestinians in Beirut when Arafat was there in 1989, they came up with a number of interesting ideas, one of which was a Benelux situation, which I would look at again. We have a federation, and you know, you and I have talked about Belgium and Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. You and I talked about this 15 years ago,
right.
But maybe it's time to revisit it, where you have Israel, a West Bank, Gaza, Palestinian state, and Jordan. And if you're an Israeli Arab / Palestinian Israeli, then perhaps you could vote in the Palestinian elections, travel back and forth. Palestinians living in Jordan could also vote on that but still remain citizens of Jordan. I mean, that kind of flexibility perhaps is what we have to start looking at now.
Waleed, when you look at where we are now, and I want to go back to what the major policy Obama faces as President of the United States of America towards Middle East and the Palestinians and the Israelis, but this is a very complex situation. Now you have all these Israelis living in the West Bank in settlements that look very permanent to me, and you can't – many Palestinians argue and have argued on this program, and I've talked to and interviewed, said, how can you have a Palestinian state if it's not contiguous, if you don't have places that allow Palestinians to live completely in the land that is theirs? So, I mean, it becomes a much more complex situation to kind of parse apart.
Yeah, it's not just the settlements. It's the way, you know, they've been built, where they've been built, the land that's been confiscated. And in particular, and this was even endemic in the Oslo peace process, the way the Palestinian community within the West Bank and Gaza has really been fragmented. I mean, the process of creating the Palestinian Authority has really fragmented the community, has limited the mobility, has allowed Israel to create a kind of a regime that really controls their movement, that controls the space in which they exist in. There's been very little talk about actual Palestinian sovereignty. I mean, let alone the notion of what kind of military force or police it would have, but just the notion of rights over water, rights over airspace, things like that, actually being able to have the kind of sphere in which they are sovereign. And this has been sort of fragmented, chopped up, and controlled by a continuing occupation regime. So, you know, if there was talk about, again, a two-state solution, I mean, in addition to maybe removing settlements, it would also have to, limit, let's say, you know, Israeli authority across that line, that border. And now we have this partition barrier, you know, cutting into the West Bank. And it's not just removing it. Okay, maybe that is possible. Let's say it's possible to remove the settlements, remove the wall. But they've created a damage that the Palestinians have lived with. They lived with having land confiscated, having their access to agricultural land, you know, forbidden. They've been growing up with kids, isolated from access to this, a full range of schooling, all these things. So there's been, 10 years or more of Palestinians living under this. So that has created a damage in itself and has also had a big impact on, let's say, political perspective of Palestinians.
Well, you've had actually 7 years since the wall was built. And again, very different perspectives on the separation wall. The Israelis call it a security wall. The Palestinians call it an apartheid wall.
So it's called a barrier, I think,
yeah,
not
barrier,
a wall.
Yeah. Well, 95% of it is fence. 5% of it is wall. And, of course, when the Pope was there, he was, posed near the wall part, the 5% wall part.
Which basically surrounds Bethlehem.
Yeah. The dilemma here is basically this. The wall wasn't set up just for the sake of building a wall. It was to prevent suicide bombers from coming from the West Bank into Israel, and it was fairly successful that way. The dilemma was, instead of building the wall right on the old 67 border, they built about 7% of it, cuts out land for the Palestinians. and that would obviously have to be removed unless there was going to be a swap of land, which some people have talked about in a settlement, Israel giving up land near Gaza in return for keeping the Gush Etzion block southwest of Jerusalem, which serves to protect Jerusalem from there, and Ma'ale Adumim, which protects Jerusalem from the Israeli perspective to the east. Now, the dilemma, though, if you look at the settlements, it's not just settlements, it's settlement outposts. And what happens is, here you have a settlement, and about a kilometer from the settlement, you start building houses, and then you start building between the settlement outpost and the settlement itself, and all that does is gobble up more land and frustrate the Palestinians more. So if I were advising President Obama, the first thing I would do, I'd say, you promised to get rid of the settlement outposts, do it. And that would be my first strong recommendation.
But you have now an Israeli government that is talking about removing 60,000 Palestinians from Jerusalem, of tearing down their houses, of expanding settlements in Jerusalem itself.
Not 60,000, Mark.
What I've read was 60,000.
No, that's not correct.
The 60,000 Palestinians have built homes, built additions to their homes that are not acceptable to the Israeli government without permits, and those will be demolished.
Yeah. Well, I think what the Israelis are planning to do is make a garden around the old city.
That's a nice way of putting it.
No, garden areas. I'm putting that in quotation marks, of course. And if you look at the various Arab neighborhoods in the areas where that is, I think you're talking closer to 600 rather than 60,000. But 600 is wrong, let alone 60,000 is wrong to do it. And that's why Jerusalem has to be settled and has to be settled soon. And in talking about Jerusalem, there are two issues. One are the holy places. And we have talked about the Haram and the wall at length. And the other is dividing the city itself. And the more I think about it, is the only way you can solve the holy place problem is to have some sort of international body in control of the mosques on top of the Temple Mount Haram and the Western Wall and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and maybe add the Church of the Nativity in Jerusalem and make it a package, because otherwise it's a recipe for continued conflict.
Where do both of you think this is going to – where we're going to end up? I mean, and where President Obama's going to end up on the policy when it comes to Israelis and Palestinians in the Middle East in general. There was a lot of critique of President Barack Obama from the left and from Palestinians over his lack of statements when the Gaza incursion occurs from Israel. And that we have yet to see a real clear statement about where President Barack Obama wants to take foreign policy, where he wants to take the policy between Israelis and Palestinians. Waleed?
Yeah, I mean, I think within the Palestinian community and with the broader Arab community, it's getting kind of late. I mean, to the degree that there might have been some, you know, happiness or slight joy or relief that Obama was elected president, there's been few signs that there would be any major tangible changes. His silence during the Gaza war, I think made many people feel that they shouldn't expect much, and so most don't expect much. But let's say that he's comes up with something. Where is this going to go? It's hard to imagine. I think at some point he might realize that this two states plan, for many of the reasons we talked about, and we could go through others, is highly problematic. I mean, it's if it requires population exchanges and ethnic things like that, I think that's one of the reasons why it's problematic. If it's gonna, the settlements, unrooting the settlements and so forth. And at some point, he's gonna have to figure out what is in U.S. interest. And this gets into the broader issues. I mean, to what degree is he trying to make moves on this question because he has other regional questions to deal with, like Iran, like the future of Iraq, like the sort of the kind of Cold War that's going on and struggle for division and power and kind of the limits of American power in the region. So I think his hope was to get some sort of progress. I mean, not a solution to the conflict. I think that's kind of out of the question, but some sort of agreement that could make things better, create some stability, create some peace. And I think there's a possibility for that, but that would require giving up. That would require negotiating with Hamas. That would require conceding more than the U.S. or Israel has wanted to in this. So at some point, you might have a dilemma. Is he going to like concede some issues, or is he going to kind of just do his best and then just try to minimize the consequences?
Because, Bob Friedman, I don't know how much longer America and the world can muddle through this. We've been muddling through it for too long now, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, Obama's been criticized for, quote, silence during the Gaza war. But if you remember, candidate Obama, when he was over there, visited Sderot and mentioned, and that's the area that's been under constant rocket attack from Gaza into Israel. And he said if his daughters were under attack, he would want to retaliate. And hence, you had a long period of extended rocketry, firing of rockets from Gaza into Israel, which led to the Israeli retaliation. So there was a lot of understanding on the part of Obama and the previous administration. Look, the Israelis are acting in self-defense after being rocketed. That having been said, at least to my knowledge, Obama pressured the Israelis to stop the fighting prior to the inauguration. So they did stop before the job was finished militarily. Now, in terms of negotiating an ultimate peace, in the absence of a two-state solution, you have to look rather starkly at the alternatives. One state, then you're asking for communal conflict, whether the former Yugoslavia is an example or Georgia with South Ossetia and Abkhazia or whatever. It didn't work during the mandate period. One-state solution won't work here either because the communities are too much at each other's throat. So I go back to the idea of creative diplomacy in trying to set up this Benelux thing of Israel, a West Bank, Gaza state, and Jordan, given the linkages there.
Two questions about this Benelux solution. Well, let me come back to the Gaza, and then I'm going to talk about Benelux and how real that is. As a person from J Street, mm-hmm. kind of looking at Middle East policy from a Jewish American perspective that is different than the power of AIPAC, I want to end with that discussion, but let me come back to where you just laid off before we do that, which has to do with what happened in Gaza with Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza. And I remember when President Barack Obama said that, and I understood that viscerally as well. However, I'd also like to have seen what President Barack Obama would have said if he sat in Gaza City and looked at a Palestinian family who has been denied medicine, food, clothing, a life because of Israel shutting off the borders. And mind you, the Egyptians on the other side didn't do much better, but the Israelis were controlling the situation, and that people were economically being starved to death in Gaza for a long time since the settlements were removed. And so, and the rockets, for the most part being fired, were being fired with very little direction and there was very little human damage as opposed to the human damage going on inside of Gaza in that year since. And I didn't hear President Barack Obama say much about what was happening to the Palestinians on the ground inside of Gaza.
Well, again, if I may respond.
Well, also, if you want me to respond,
okay, yeah, if you have rockets being constantly fired at Israeli towns and people can't sleep and they're under heavy psychological pressure and kindergartens are hit and schools are hit, then no self-respecting state, Mark, is going to allow its territory to be rocketed from outside without responding. I give you an example. Were Mexico to fire rockets at the United States across the Rio Grande, for example, the United States would retaliate strongly against Mexico.
Except we weren't blocking off the border so Mexican children didn't have medicine and didn't have food.
Excuse me. Let's be very careful about that. When did that start?
I don't care when
it
started.
It started not in 2005. It started in 2007 after Hamas seized power. And after Hamas said very bluntly, it's our goal to destroy Israel, and they keep saying that. Now, from the Israeli perspective, are you going to allow a group of people in control of territory whose goal is to destroy you to build themselves up economically, to build themselves up politically, or do you want to make it as difficult as possible for them to do that until and unless they change their policy and say, okay, were willing to sit down and talk peace with Israel.
But if
medicine has gotten in, food has gotten in, nobody is starving. What the issue
is— That's not true, by the way. People are starving, and it has dribbled in.
What is not going in is reconstruction, is cement, steel reinforcing bars. And the reason for that is these are also being used or confiscated by Hamas to build tunnels connecting Egypt and Gaza to smuggle in weapons.
So, Waleed Husband?
Just think of this in terms of, I mean, the way Bob outlined some of these issues relating to Israeli security and the threats posed to it, I mean— you know, you have to bring into the discussion, the situation for Palestinian security. I mean, many of the conditions that he described, the Israeli citizens in Sderot facing are kind of parallel or during that period of the rocket fires, which have now stopped. And Hamas's main demand was an end to the siege. And that's what they wanted to negotiate. And that's what Israel failed or refused to negotiate, to agree to, an ending of the siege, which is quite equivalent to a declaration of war in the sense of sieging another sort of people. If we think about this dynamic in terms of, Palestinians, human security and well-being and the conditions that they've faced, you see that for a long time, people living under occupation, living under a siege, are living in a context where they're living on permanent insecurity. And that's such a critical issue. And this thing about what Obama could have said, he could express some humanitarian concern, and also the notion that somehow within this process we need to promote Israeli security, but we also need to have some consideration of Palestinian security and well-being. And that's the only way there's going to be some sort of solution. And that really hasn't, come onto the table. They've talked about, this notion about how do we divide Jerusalem and so forth. Doesn't really get to the day-to-day concerns of what sort of is at the heart of, I think, the conflict.
And Obama today did talk about the people living in Gaza and their problems. And he said something along the lines, yes, we worry about Israeli security. We have to worry about the living conditions for the people in Gaza. So he actually said that today publicly.
As much as some people outside of Israel were not happy with the election results that took place in Israel, the reality was that Hamas won the election among the Palestinians. And then after they won the election, they were literally starved out in many ways by the West and by the Israelis because they won the election. But the reality is they won the election because of the corruption of the Palestinian Authority, and they won the election because Palestinians were sick and tired. In a show we had on this program, secular Palestinians, our old friend Ali Zagab, who's on the show many times over the last 16 years, said, as much as I hate Hamas, I would vote for Hamas in the next election on the West Bank because of what – and they won the election. And then they were starved out politically and other ways as well. So we can't have it both ways, can we?
Well, let me just remind you, Mark, that Hitler was elected in Germany by a popular vote. And just because somebody's elected by a popular vote, does that make this person clean and sacrosanct? You have to look at what is the strategy.
Does that mean that people like Avigdor Lieberman shouldn't been allowed to stand up because of their racist statements as well?
He's for a two-state solution, as I try to remind you.
And also a racist.
Let me put this way. Hamas is still devoted to the destruction of the state of Israel. That is a fact. When they change their policy and don't work for the destruction of the state of Israel, then it's possible, and if Obama can use some creative diplomacy to bring Hamas around to change its policy, to have more than, we'll have a 10-year truce, and during that time, of course, we'll build up and get weapons, et cetera, for the next round, that's something the Israelis aren't going to accept, Mark.
So where do you think, it's what the Palestinians will accept as well, so where do you think we go here in the next, where does President Barack Obama go and where the Palestinians and Israelis go in the next year as we're figuring out this policy?
Well, I mean, Waleed,
Bob.
I think if they made careful, I mean, one of the things that's the Palestinians have failed to come to a unity agreement. And a lot of that in Abu Mazen, the president of Mahmoud Abbas, has basically been seeking to go without Hamas. And the U.S. are sort of backing him in this. And so one thought is that if the U.S. says, well, what would be best in the interest of Palestinians and Israelis in the United States would be to bring together gather the Palestinian community on the West Bank and Gaza into some sort of unity government and declare that if they did come to agreement and there were certain conditions that would include no rocket fires and so forth, that the U.S. would give aid and negotiate with the president of the PLO, Mahmoud Abbas, that might be the president also of the Palestinian Authority that had Hamas within the government. Something like that could become the basis for some negotiations, the basis for some agreements that would increase security on both sides. I think that's where you would need to begin, because any solution down the road would have to be one that's supported by the greater Palestinian community. And that would include the Palestinians in West Bank and Gaza, the ones in Israel, and the ones in the diaspora. In the sense, if you really wanted to sort of close off this notion of the Palestinian problem, you would really need to have that broader support. And having a very narrowly sort of legitimacy of the current Palestinian Authority president, he's not going to really be able to close a deal with broad support.
Gentlemen, this has been a really inspiring and interesting show. It's always a pleasure. I'm glad that both of you could be on this program together. Dr. Robert Friedman, Bob, it's always good to have you on the air. Thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure, Mark.
Waleed Husban, I'm glad you could join us, and we look forward to having you back many more times.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
Good to have you both here. And we'll continue taking a look at this subject and many more. I want to thank both of our guests for joining us this hour. I'm reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month's Urbanite delves into hidden phenomena, shadowy characters, undisclosed locations, and other mysteries of Baltimore. It's the Secrets Issue. Available now at over 800 locations around the region and online at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, and Jackson Hubolt. Theme music by Juan Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.